scoop.
She's the woman who clinched the 2019 interview with Prince Andrew, described as, and get this, a plane crashing into an oil tanker, causing a tsunami, triggering a nuclear explosion. She has many things besides the first in the family to go to university, a trained barrister, a single mum, a master of persuasion, and she was, to her former BBC colleagues, the booker extraordinaire, responsible for many of New Night's exclusives, including Stormy Daniels, Sean Spicer, Steven Seagal, and Julian Assange. Delighted to be joining me live on the line to tell us all about behind the scenes and scoops and booking and the booking itself. Sam McAllister. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning from London.
Good to have you with us. It is one of the most difficult things to do. You think it would be quite easy to get guests on a show, but when they are perhaps being a little bit controversial, if they don't really want to talk about a certain subject, then I wouldn't say dark arts, but you can need a special skill set, shall we say?
Let's leave it a special skill set, shall we, Giles? We've only just met. I think that's absolutely true. And you're absolutely right. I think for people who aren't in the production or the media industry, it kind of looks like everything magically arrives. A sort of delivery fairy brings interviews to leaders and they just kind of land there and the magic starts. But in truth, as absurd as it sounds, given the size of something like the BBC and obviously the acclaim of a programme like Newsnight and the fame of a presenter like Emily Maitlis, it is like getting blood from a stone, generally, let alone with someone of the kind of level that I used to negotiate for.
And so how do you go about? I mean, because I mean, there's a lot of difference between if you like getting hold of a newsworthy subject and doing a puff piece, which is basically when you've got a PR agency saying, look, we've got a client, he wants to talk about their new whatever. And you have to say, well, actually, we can't do that because we're an independent news gathering organisation.
Yeah, the double horror is that when you do get that kind of thing, on the rare occasion that somebody would actually call me, because 99 times out of 100, I'd be calling them, we probably had to say no, because the words you use, puff piece, which are the industry term for a kind of suck up item, where you sort of say what they want you to say and you don't ask any difficult questions, we're not allowed to do them. And rightly so. But it does mean that when you get the opportunity of an easy get, you just can't take it. So most of my time was spent trying to find what I'd call the sweet spot, that little thing that means the difference between a yes and a no.
And how did you find yourself in this position? Because did you decide that getting these guests was what, I mean, how did you go about getting into the BBC, getting onto Newsnight, you know, the brilliant Newsnight? How did you find yourself there, as it were?
Yeah, it's so random, right? So actually, I grew up at one stage, actually, I was in Andorra. My parents, I'll be blunt, they were tax exiles. So they were expats at one stage too, and they were in Andorra for a year or so. And I went to university first in my family to do so. They were market traders in the past. So we had the gift of the gab for sprats and loins, as the case may be. But I went to university, I started to be a barrister, and I didn't enjoy it. I left. And I had to find a new job. So I asked some mates if they could recommend anything. And I ended up a couple of days at the BBC. Then I was at Radio 4. Didn't quite fit me. You can probably tell I'm a little bit brassy. No disrespect to myself. It's just true. I'm quite exuberant. And television was probably a better fit. And I ended up for a day at Newsnight, where everybody wants to be Martin Scorsese and make a little film. Those beautiful films that often win awards and they make people kind of famous for being mini filmmakers. But I'll be honest with you, Giles, it never appealed to me. The thing I loved was that moment of jeopardy where Paxman or Maitlis or Kirsty Walk, whoever it is, has the guest under the studio lights and you're sitting at home and you can't breathe because you're waiting for them to fall or prosper. One or the other, but that was the TV gold that I became addicted to.
And it's interesting, because do you have any idea about how good or bad they're going to be? We'll talk about Andrew in a little bit, but you know, people like Sean Spicer, people like Stormy Daniels, who you would think, given her interesting and colourful background, might not be comfortable in front of a camera, let me rephrase that, or Assange, for example.
Naughty. Well, that's the thing. thing. I love these. I love the counterintuitive guests. So the joy of having been a criminal defense barrister is you dealt with, let's put it in brackets, alleged criminals all the time. So I'd have to walk into a cell with an alleged triple murderer or paedophile, or more likely shoplifter. Let's not over glamorize. And I had to basically make sure that they were in a position that they felt I was giving them a fair hearing, right? And so when I went into my interviews and my negotiations, I'd have an open mind on how it was going to go. That sounds insane with someone like Prince Andrew, but no one thinks they're going to do a bad interview. And the job of the negotiator is to always be open-minded and fair with them, but ultimately it's their answers. And Stormy is a great example because, you know, you might think that she might not be the best interviewee. I knew that she was really, really good on the phone. She was really formidable. And she was brilliant because she listened to questions, she answered them, and she's her own woman. She's got no rules.
Isn't, yeah, and that's perhaps one of the tricks that other people don't do is listening to, you know, if you're being interviewed, listen to what the guy is saying, or the person, excuse me, is saying, rather than try and run down your own set of rules, your own agenda, because otherwise, especially with the high quality, the high caliber stuff, we've got a Paxman, a Matter, whatever, you're going to come a cropper because they're going to put the small dagger between the ribs, aren't they?
Absolutely right. And I think that the small dagger between the ribs is really easy to place if you're not listening and you're doing, you know, like, I don't know whether you did university or you did your A-levels or any of that jazz. And they'd be like, you'd studied Macbeth and then they ask about Hamlet. And then you go, well, you know, in order to talk about Hamlet, we have to talk about Macbeth. And often with political interviews, you feel that they've got a destination and they're going there and the questions are irrelevant and nobody believes that. If you're watching that, you know that doesn't have integrity. You know that doesn't have honesty, and it's not a good way to do an interview.
So with Andrew, I mean, this isn't a case that you phone up his people and they say, you know, we've got a spare slot next week. Do you fancy it? I mean, how do you go about getting the contacts in there or making the contacts? And everybody who saw this in hindsight went, how on earth did his people not see this coming? Who thought this was a good idea?
I think the problem with someone like Andrew is that with many famous or infamous people, they have people around them who are basically being paid to be nice to them and to tell them that they're great. I don't know if you have someone like that, but how wonderful. I'd absolutely love one, you know, if anyone's available.
Yeah, sometimes it's the cat, but only sometimes, yeah.
Well, my cat might appear. She's called Oreo. If she meows, that's her.
That's fine.
But sometimes you really do find that is a fatal flaw. And most of the time you've got people around you who are telling you you're amazing and you may not be. So I think the starting point is that when people decide to do interviews, they obviously think they are going to be amazing. That's a fact, even if you are Prince Andrew. And in this case, I spent up to a year from the first email where, unbelievably, they approached me, a PR agency working with Prince Andrew, to do a puff piece, as we've already termed, about his charity, which no longer really exists, Pitch at the Palace for Entrepreneurs. We declined on the spot because we don't do those kinds of pieces. And I signed it off jars with these words that I always put on emails that I had to decline, and they never, ever work. And it says, if things change and Prince Andrew decides that he wants to do a wider interview, do let me know. Obviously, you're never going to hear from them again because we'd never even done a royal interview at Newsnight, and we're not really known for kind of, you know, being kind to people on set. So, you know, you didn't really think this was going to happen. Lo and behold, 6 months later, you know, amazing email comes into my box. Actually, Sam, Prince Andrew is now interested in doing what we'd call a news interview, a wider interview. Are you free on Monday to come to Buckingham Palace to meet his chief of staff? Well, I tell you what, I was free to come on Monday to meet his chief of staff. And so I went on my own, didn't even tell my boss, because who's going to agree to do an interview with Newsnight? And he wasn't even in that much trouble at that stage. Epstein wasn't, yeah, he wasn't dead. Maxwell was still at large. He wasn't facing this huge litigation in the way that he was later. So off I popped to Buckingham Palace on effectively, you know, road to nowhere, thinking it was going to be not a waste of time, but it wasn't going to happen. And I did all my research. I turned up to meet his chief of staff, and there we were, face to face for the first time inside Buckingham Palace. What a bizarre experience.
But it as you said, it's the research, it's doing the background, because if you go into something like this sort of not prepared, you're not going to get very far with it. But you realise quite quickly that Andrew was on a path to what he thought was rehabilitation, or at least getting his royal brownie points up and his public perception up, and he thought that this would be quote-unquote a good thing to get back on track, get back on message.
Well, that goes back, doesn't it, to the thing that we've discussed already, which is, you know, what are they looking for and what are they going to get out of it? And for him, obviously, he wanted to put himself back into public life. He felt, it seems mad now, but that this might be the opportunity to vindicate himself, to clear his name. And that was always the thrust of my argument throughout. It was not, you will clear your name, because that would be misleading. But my thrust was, and being an ex-criminal defense barrister, in the later negotiations where we actually negotiated face to face, he was frankly completely obsessed with my criminal defense background. And being a criminal defense barrister, you know, I was just frank with him. You know, the inference that the country draws nowadays, if you say nothing, frankly, is guilt. So this is a chance. You're throwing the dice. Do you have good answers? I said this to his face. Do you have legitimate reasons? Do you have explanations? If you feel this is your chance to vindicate yourself, that's a matter for you. You know, are you up to that? Do you have truths that you can give that will explain your behavior? Can you get yourself out of this? That's not for us. That was his problem, and boy, was it his problem.
How was the reaction of the Newsnight team of Emily Maitlis, of Paxman, for example, when you said, by the way, I've got Prince Andrew, who, you know, is it, who wants first dibs in that situation? Is there an unseemly scrum across the newsroom at Newsnight as they dash towards you?
Well, basically, I was Emily's interviews producer. So Emily came to the second negotiation with me. So we had like an interim negotiation in October where I took Emily along. I'd never had her with me on anything. I always negotiated alone. She was, of course, fabulous, but she did come to Buckingham Palace with me. We were like two kind of like overwhelmed. I'm not going to say schoolgirls. That sounds kind of pejorative, but, you know, it was quite an overwhelming situation. So we did a second negotiation with Amanda, me, her, and Emily. And the third negotiation, which was on the Monday, and you guys saw the interview on Saturday, we recorded it on Thursday. They said, yes, on Tuesday, please. Sorry, that's quite complicated, but it was over 6 days. But Emily had been there with me. So she knew what he might say, but I'm sure neither of us believe that he would say those things that you heard on camera. Because you'll know this, Giles, the space between what we call the briefing call, where the producer comes in and goes, Giles, it's the best interview. Oh my God, it's 10 out of 10. It's amazing. And then you get them on the line and it turns out they don't say any of the stuff they said to the producer. And then you look like a bit of an idiot. Well, this was the one time that he said all of the things he'd said in the negotiation, which we probably believed he would never say on camera.
And the other thing is the fact that obviously he's done this now, you know, there was no way the palace could pull that. In a free and what's it democracy, we couldn't say, well, actually the interview was a complete what's it up, and we can't let you that can't possibly go out, etc.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I would say that on the objective level, but on the subjective level, you know, it was the longest 48 hours of my life. I mean, you would think, wouldn't you, that the machinations of what they call the establishment, which sadly I'm not part of, would somehow kind of flip into view. There'd be a call to the director general, some very expensive lawyer would get involved, because I didn't see a lawyer the whole way through, but nothing happened. They took it on the nose.
Wow. One of the great things about doing this job is the fact that when an interview goes really well, you know, you leave with this amazing sense of if you get a point across that the interviewee wants to make or whatever, or they tell you something, and it can completely change the way that you look, your perception of a particular issue. When you sat in there with Prince Andrew 15 feet away from you and in Emily Maitlis's direct line of fire, did you have one of those sort of earth-shifting, earth-tilting moments when you realised what was coming out of his mouth and you thought, my goodness, this is going to be... Because it is, you know, Martin Bish... And let's not even go down the road, but the Diana Princess of Wales interview is one everybody remembers. The Prince Andrew interview is one that everybody will remember for decades.
I completely agree. I mean, it was the biggest interview since then. And, you know, in fairness, it was also obviously obtained in a completely different way to Bashir. Let's not go there, but obviously extremely angry about how that happened. But yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was maybe 2 feet from him during the face-to-face negotiation, maybe a foot, even less. I'm not really that good with distance, I apologise. But I was next to him apart from Emily. But to be 15 feet behind him and to hear those same words, imagine the poker face. I mean, I'm an ex-criminal defence barrister. You know, so the problem with the things that he put forward, Giles, and remember, we've changed the lexicon to be pretentious for a moment. We launched 1,000 memes. You guys never talked about Pizza Express woking or No Sweat prior to this interview. That was not a thing, right? So we've literally changed the lexicon. Anne and Deck mentioned it. That was my proudest moment. Right. You know, my mum was very excited. So these things we'd already heard, you'd never heard them. As I was sitting there and he actually said it on camera, I mean, I was mostly looking at the floor because the producer's job in that situation is to make no eye contact with anybody and just stop yourself from coughing, you know, moving, eye rolling, no reaction. So the floor was my companion for about half of the interview and trying not to look at Emily was my companion for the rest.
And when you walk out and get in the cab or get in the car or whatever, do you just, because, you know, did you have one of those high-fiving moments, I suppose? I mean, when you walk out, when you've been cool and composed, and Emily was absolutely on the nail with that one.
And it was amazing.
She must have been, her brain must have been going, I can't believe it's not butter either. And you're the same. And then you say, thank you very much. Was there any realization that was he completely impervious to what he had said? Was he absolutely down that track that what he was saying was explaining in a clear and concise way that he didn't sweat and he was at the Pizza Express?
Well, I mean, as the interview finished and my eyes raised, something quite extraordinary happened. I turned to the equerry next to me. She's like a royal executive assistant. And I have a real problem, having been a journalist and a lawyer, that I'm really bad at lying. If only I was good at it. I can't do fake. And so I had to say something to her. So my voice went a bit high-pitched. And I went, so how do you think it went? High-pitched voice. And she replied, wasn't he marvellous? And Giles, in all sincerity, I replied, yes, he was. And my eyes lift and I see that room. And for the first time, I realise something extraordinary. The schism, the space between the journalists all going, oh, my God, this is like the worst interview ever. Me as a criminal defence barrister too, going, oh, my God, you literally just set yourself up for litigation. And Prince Andrew looking pleased as punch. And get this, offering us all a tour of the palace, which Emily went on for about 20 minutes, I think. I declined because I couldn't face him asking me, as he inevitably would, how did it go? So we leave. We actually did take a cab that day. I got a bus there because I'm very careful with licensed fee payers' money, always have been. But we did get a cab back. I apologise. I felt it was only fair. And I was in the cab with the other two producers, Stu, who was the exec, and Jake, the other producer. And we get in that car and they're talking about the news lines, as you do after an interview. And I said, Pizza Express woking, No Sweat. Obviously, no apology, huge issue. But that is the thing that the public will latch onto. And it really is the epitome of everything that went wrong with this catastrophic answers.
It is one of those moments. So why the book? Because it is, as we said before, a peculiar skill set. It is, you know, a specialized skill set. Why did you decide that you should let the greater public and myself into the world of, you know, getting those interviews, what goes right, what goes wrong, and the Prince Andrew? I mean, because it's not just Andrew. I mean, there's an awful lot of other ones.
No, absolutely. Of course, it's going to be the focus. It is one of the most important interviews, you know, ever in broadcasting. I completely understand that. The reason why the book is that effectively, though we're now talking about this story, I didn't tell my story of how it came about because nobody else knew apart from me. And Emily wasn't able to tell that story because, you know, she didn't go through it personally. So I haven't told how it happened. And I'm the only person in the world who actually knows the whole process because I was the only one there from the beginning. And I do think, to be pretentious for a moment, I hope you'll forgive me, on a human level, obviously, this is a moment in my history. I'm a tiny, tiny part of this extraordinary, important story. Most importantly, the victims who face this terrible situation that this interview helped in some way, I believe, resolve in terms of litigation and outcomes. And then in a larger sense, this is a moment in my country's history. This has never happened before, stepping back like this. And in the future, you know, when people look back at how this came about and what happened, here's the pretentious part. My tiny part of that is actually a part of our country's history, and that's why I wanted people to know about it.
But here's the thing, you see, without that interview, and I'm not blowing proverbially up your nose or whatever, but without that interview, the general public would never have seen Prince Andrew and how he thought, how his thought process worked. And therefore, if that interview hadn't aired, the general public would be thinking, Andrew, you know, war hero, celebrity, it's a knockout back then, there, in those days, and not have the opinion. And yet, because that aired, you now have, allegedly, the future one generation skip down William, saying there's no way that Andrew will be allowed. He's been, obviously, his royal titles have gone, and his rehabilitation, even when he was walking with the Queen recently, you know, there is an automatic gut reaction almost from the nation, a national gut reaction to the fact of what this man was alleged to have been done, and the victims had closure.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I think that we forget because of all the kind of, you know, obviously there is a lot of hilarity with the interview, but there is a very, very serious side. And remember, after this interview happened, obviously the litigation, which was successful in terms of the settlement, and also Maxwell, she was arrested after this happened. And there were stories, excuse me, at the time, that she believed that the interview was the reason they came looking for her twice as hard. I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, she was arrested after. So the protagonists in this sorry, sorry tale, Epstein dead, Maxwell convicted, Prince Andrew litigation successful. We've got really a very different outcome. And the interview is a very small part of that. Obviously, Virginia Roberts and the other victims are the ones who took the terrible toll and worked so tirelessly for years. But it's a small part in assisting the outcome. And I think that's important to talk about.
The book is called Scoops, Behind the Scenes of the BBC's Most Shocking Interviews. It is by Sam McAllister, who we've been speaking to today. Sam, if people want to find you online, where can they find out more about you and more about the book?
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's available all good booksellers, but I think there's a stock problem. I've been very lucky. So we're on Amazon, but I'm on Twitter and you can't get rid of me. I do apologize. I'm all over the place at the moment. Daily Mail this morning, Lorraine, we're everywhere. And there's going to be a film too. So you'll be stuck with me in your cinemas. But who plays me, Giles? That's the glib question we need to answer.
Well, it will indeed. Well, we'll have answers on a postcard to that one. I'm just thinking, I mean, obviously now you get bookers trying to book you. So the wheel has turned full circle.
It's my happiest moment to be nice to them as they deserve. And make sure you're nice to your producer. I'm coming for you, Giles.
Trust me. I am very, very good to my presenting. I am just the monkey. They are the organ grinders, as I always say to people.
Love to hear it.
The book is called Scoops, Behind the Scenes of the BBC's Most Shocking Interviews. We didn't even talk about Steven Seagal, but I'm going to crash the news, and that's the cardinal sin. It's by Sam McAllister. Sam, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Ciao.